Kia ora and welcome to Sobriety Chat. I'm your host, Lotta Dan, otherwise known as Mrs. D. I am the community manager and content creator here at Living Sober. And I'm joined today by Simone Barclay. Now, Simone is a psychologist. She's an addiction clinician. She's a mother. She's a wife. She's a skier. She's a restorer of vintage furniture. And she is sober. Yes, welcome, Simone.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Lotta. Yeah, quite an introduction.
Yeah, well, it's a real treat to be chatting with you today, because we were just saying before I hit record that we've sort of danced around each other in the sector for many years and never actually connected.
Yeah, very much like ships in the night.
That's right, but I'm a great admirer of what you do, and yeah, likewise. It's really great to be able to talk to you today. So before we get into the work that you do, because you're very much in this space of helping others and, you know, being very aware of this alcohol culture we live in, I would like, if it's okay, to start with a bit of your story. And I know it's been a while since you had your last drink. How long?
Yeah, it's coming up for 26 years.
Amazing.
I know, I can't quite believe it myself. Thank you.
So yeah, tell us, what can you remember about, if we can go back to, you know, just very briefly, your drinking story and what led you to stop?
Yeah, it's interesting because 26 years or not, it's vivid. It's vivid in my mind. And I don't really think I'll ever forget, because it's such a, you know, it was such a pivotal point, stopping and realizing what alcohol was taking from me. But I guess I started drinking, you know, I had a very, love to blame my family, but poor things, they did nothing wrong. You know, very modest drinkers themselves, and I had a very, you know, loving average upbringing. But I got to, I think, 14, and I went to a friend, her older sister was turning 21, and she was allowed to bring a friend, and the friend was me. And we were sneaking drinks from, you know, everywhere. And I got quite drunk and I loved it. I just thought, oh my God, this is who I've always wanted to be. This happy, outgoing, clever, funny person who knows what to say at the right time. And it was quite profound, that feeling that, wow, alcohol changes me so that I feel like everybody else looks on the outside. You know, that feeling that everybody else knows how to do it and you kind of don't quite, you're not in on the secret. And alcohol really changed that. So, yeah, for a long time after that, it was just drinking socially, like many teenagers, binge drinking, like many teenagers. I wouldn't necessarily say it was, you know, a problem at that point, apart from the fact that, you know, I never drank to be social. I drank for the effect. If I wasn't going to get an effect, there wasn't any point. And then at some point, it just became what I did when faced with anything remotely challenging. So, you know, if I was a little bit anxious about something, I'd have a drink. If I was upset, I'd drink. If I was angry, I would drink. If I was nervous, I'd have a drink. And it didn't really seem to matter what time of day it was, you know. So I would be drinking at all sorts of times of day. And I knew that wasn't right. So I would try and hide that. But as well as that, I also had the, you know, a bottle of wine in the fridge at the end of the day. I pour myself a drink and but I could never really just stop at one. And I guess it really just progressed from there. I think I knew from quite early on I didn't drink like other people, but it wasn't so much I thought I had a problem. It was more like, you don't understand. This is kind of what I really need. It's a little bit like if I had, you know, I'm thinking, you know, it's people who wear hair extensions. It's kind of like, it's not, you don't have a problem with your hair, you just like it a particular way, you know? And that was what I thought about drinking. I don't have a problem. I just like being like this.
What was, but so without getting too deep and don't overshare if you don't want to. But what was going on that you really felt that you it was such an emotional coping mechanism, and that you really, I mean, that's so powerful the way you describe at 14 of like, this is just making me feel like everyone else must be feeling, like there was something that was feeling not right. And yeah, what do you think was going on with that?
I think that was a kid who is fundamentally shy and an introvert, not pathologically so, but just, you know, that was part, that's part of my makeup. I'm an introvert, I'm quite shy, I like small groups, not large groups, and probably quite a bit of anxiety. I worried about a lot of things, you know, just mildly, not you know, chronic anxiety. But I was also in that family of an era where, you know, oh, I'm a bit nervous. You've got no reason to be nervous. That's just ridiculous. You know, you don't talk about these things.
Minimize.
Absolutely, yeah. Have a cup of tea and a lie down and you'll be fine. Nothing an early night won't fix, you know. So,
just saying, that's what I used to get. It'll be fine. It's all good. Yeah. It seems like a little breezy statement, but it really just minimises what you're trying to express or feel. So you just feel the sense of, I've got to hold this in and squash it down. And, I mean, alcohol is the perfect thing because it's right there. It's acceptable, and it does what we want.
Does that squashing down so well, doesn't it? Yeah,
I love how you describe that you're an introvert and you like small groups and you get energy. Like, it's, you know that now, and it's so easy to vocalize. But that is especially as a teenager, where you feel like, as you say, everyone else in the world's got it all sorted. They're all confident, and I'm the only one. And understanding yourself to where you know that you're not good in large groups, you know that you're shy, and that's okay. That is a big process to get to where you're comfortable with that.
Absolutely. Absolutely it is. And I think as a society, we reward extroversion, you know. Extroverts are rewarded and accoladed. Oh, she's so bubbly, she's outgoing. So, you know, and if you're an introvert, you know, that you're always trying to be that person. And so, of course, you're going to drink, because how else can you be something that you're not? And I often say to people now, you know, how can I be in a social situation? How can I be social when I'm not drinking? I'm kind of like, it's not so much about learning to be okay socially or okay in a big group or, you know, giving a lot of yourself out, as it is about learning to be okay not being like that. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not the life and soul of the party, and that's okay. You know,
yeah. Either you're the quiet person in the corner having little one-on-one conversations and leaving early, or you're the person who says thank you, but I'm unavailable.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Someone said to me quite early on in my sobriety, you be the quiet, wise one. I'm like, oh, okay, that's a role I can, you know, instead of being the bubbly kid dancing on the table, I'll be the quiet, wise one, minus the wise. But people don't know that.
Funnily enough, I used to judge those people, but also envy them when I was boozy and noisy and chaotic and messy and all the rest of it at so many parties for so many years. The people sitting on the sofa quietly, I would sort of not want to go near, for starters, but also I was quietly sort of curious about them, like, how could they be doing that and be okay? Like, yeah, I love that. You're the wise person. Anyway, tell us, so what happened at your point of change? What got you to the point where you were like, I'm taking it out of my life?
So I guess it was that Swiss cheese model, you know, a whole lot of factors aligned to make it time. And I'd had the implosion of a relationship. I wouldn't even say the end, it just imploded. It was so many sort of consequences. And it was a relationship really that was an extension of my addiction. It was someone entirely inappropriate who fueled that sense of, whoa, life's so exciting. And I was confusing excitement with drama. And so, yeah, that imploded and kind of left me very alone. And, you know, work was wobbling and, you know, just everything sort of happened at the same time. And I remember really surrendering to alcohol. You know, I was trying to sort of manage it so I could still function. But I just remember thinking, oh, actually, I give up. I can't. And then, so I drank, you know, sort of daily for a while. And then I realized, well, this is miserable too. You know, this is awful. I can't drink. I'm not getting the effect I want. I'm a mess. Everybody's, you know, I can't hold down a job. I'm almost unemployable. My family are just not knowing what to do. And I guess it was that point where drinking wasn't working. I couldn't quite get enough to, I don't know, get what I wanted. It didn't kill the bad feelings. It didn't give me a sense of, you know, hope and optimism and joy like it had previously. I just suddenly woke up to the fact the answer's not here. It's just not here. What I want is I'm not going to find it in a bottle. And it was absolutely terribly terrifying.
Oh,
because
I know the feeling.
Where is it? Yeah, totally. And when previously when people had said to me I might should stop or cut down, I'd be like, well, why would I do that? It's the one thing that's good and is fun and makes me feel like life's worth living. Why would I take that away? And suddenly even that wasn't working. I'm kind of like, man, I'm just, what's left? It felt like a very hopeless place to be. So I guess from there, what I learned was, you know, it's not about the drinking. It's absolutely not about the drinking. It's about the living sober. I couldn't do that. That was what I couldn't do. But at the same time, the drinking had, by this point, you know, carved in those neural pathways where anytime I had an unpleasant emotion or it got to 4 o'clock in the afternoon or any of those other habitual things, I was hardwired to reach for a drink. So fighting those two things, what I want is over here, but man, I've got this powerful kind of need to pour this liquid into me. And it did give me a sense of, but you know, man, I was so fast. Yeah, it's a tricky time.
Tricky time, and it's the hardest thing because, as we said before, it works in the moment to do what we want, which is give us that dopamine hit, take the edge off, relax the shoulders, stop the brain chatter, whatever, make us feel confident at a party. And so there's that tricky period of transition where you're dealing with the cravings and you're trying to undo all that conditioning and then learn how to deal with stress and emotion and socializing. I mean, it's anyone who does it is a freaking legend. Our members, I'm always saying to them, you guys are heroes, and hold on, I promise it gets easier. Hold on, and they've got to grit through those phases because then, oh my gosh, the freedom comes and you learn about yourself. You learn that you're introverted. You learn it's okay to be quiet at a party or not go. You learn all the stuff. And it's, I mean, tell me your thoughts, because I can rave on about how amazing and worth it it is. What was your sort of experience once you'd gone through that difficult period and you started settling into the genuine Simone?
Yeah. I think I just kept, for me, it was really important to keep my eye on the prize. Like, I knew what I wanted. I knew the kind of life I wanted. And I knew the kind of person I wanted to be. I had a blueprint for who I wanted to be. And that wasn't anything different or amazing from, you know, what I'd been brought up with. A set of values. You know, I want to be someone who's respected. I want to be someone who can be relied on. I want to be, thought to do well in my job, blah, 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 blah. I want to have a family. I want to be with a... You know, I want to be those things. And I had all these values and these goals, but I couldn't achieve those when I was drinking. So I just had to keep my eye on that prize, you know, the bigger picture. I'd love to say I stopped drinking and that was it for me. It wasn't. I slipped and slid for a year. And it was just about putting things into place so that I didn't need to drink, you know, so that I had some other coping mechanisms. But, you know, it is really hard. A metaphor I often use is, you know, if you walk into the water at a surf beach, you know, very quickly you're in the break zone and you got, you know, waves smashing, knocked off your feet, and you're, you know, it's but you just keep going out, and before you know it, you're behind the breakers and you're just, you know, smoothly riding over the waves, and you look back and, you know, everyone else in the break zone, some people are riding their boogie board in, good on them. Others like me were just getting smashed in the white water, and I'm out and past it. So, and every time I would pick up a drink, give in and go, oh, damn it, I can't do it, I'd kind of be back in that break zone. Oh, God, you know, just got to get out past those days.
I love that metaphor. I've not heard that before. And now that's where we are, right? We're over out the back trying to wave people through. And look at you now. You've got the prize. You said your eye on the prize of this life where you're respected and you're working hard and you've got a family, and it's like tick, tick, tick. So great example of visualizations coming to reality. So talk a bit now about the work that you're doing, because you work hard helping others one-on-one and other sort of settings and speaking out in the media. There was a great piece in The Listener recently. I'll put a link to it if I can find it online in the description for this video. But, talk about the work you're doing now and the people you're helping. Is it fulfilling? Is it hard? Is it busy? How's it going?
Yeah, it's busy. It is busy in a good way. I work in private practice, and I contract to one non-governmental organisation. So, you know, and it's a growth industry. But, you know, it's immensely fulfilling. But I've got to say that, you know, for every 10 people you try and help, you might get one over the line, you know. That's possibly a – no, look, it probably is about right. One over the line in the short term anyway, but you certainly, you know, I don't underestimate the seeds that I plant, and, you know, people know what to do and where to come when they are ready. But quite often, you know, people turn up and they're just not ready. They've been influenced by family or they've had a crisis, but they're just not quite, you know, not quite all in. And
you mean they've been influenced by family or a crisis to bring them to you?
That's right.
But they haven't actually done that themselves in their head to where they're still in that fear zone or whatever you want to call it of.
Often. So they're still in the, I can't imagine my life without this, and why would I? Yeah. And also this, you know, he's doing it, she's doing it, they're doing it. Why can't I? I don't want to be different. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, that one person that you get over the line, it's worth it all. It really is, you know. Mm-hmm. I just find myself almost tearful thinking of these people and the, you know, the mountain they've climbed emotionally and socially. So, it is terribly, terribly rewarding. And the NGO that I do some work for, they do, you know, some group work as well. And I'm sitting around in these groups looking at all these people, you know, and that I just look at them and think, these people are here saving their lives. You know, it feels really meaningful. It does, you know, it is meaningful. It's meaningful work.
Mm. Yeah, and it is. That is saving lives. We can't ignore the fact that a big part of what is stacked against people is the environment we live in, where, you know, this drug is so normalized. And you and I have been saying it till the cows come home, but it's so normalized, it's so glorified, it's so cheap, it's so socially acceptable. It's the only drug you're judged for not taking. That is a big factor in people getting sober or entering recovery or whatever, however you want to call it, because, you feel like you're the one that's broken or wrong, or you're going to be outside of the fun, and it's just a huge elephant in the room that you can't shift.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And it's I feel like I've woken up to a lie. It's a massive, insidious lie that alcohol tells us that everybody who's trying to, you know, market alcohol tells us, that society's telling us that this makes life better in every way. And I just feel like I've woken up to it and gone, what on earth, you know, why is my life better or worse for that matter because of what's in my glass? You know, or yeah, it's just such a it's such a collective kind of delusion, I think. Yeah.
Yes. It is. Oh, yeah. we need change. We need change to come in the form of regulations if we're really going to shift the culture. But I believe things are slowly shifting. I mean, even in the 10 years since I got sober and sort of entered the world of blogging, and I mean, even now online, the sober, curious, grey area drinking, whatever you want to call it, you know, the influencers in that space, the podcasts, the books, has exploded. So there's like a groundswell of people. It's not, it's more, still you're outnumbered, but it is more common for people to say they're not drinking and to be open about having a problem with it. So there is hope, right?
I think you're right. I do believe that. There absolutely is hope. There is an increasing community of people that are kind of waking up to it, that, you know, that it potentially is okay to not drink. One of the things I'm really passionate about is sober-friendly workplaces. You know, I used to work in an advertising agency and you know, there was nothing. I would have water, you know, when I wasn't drinking, because that's all there was. There was nothing for someone who wasn't drinking, or, you know, whereas there's a whole lot of drinks now available that you can get that aren't necessarily lemonade. Or, you know, so, but yeah, so right. Friendly workplaces, I think that's so important. I really do.
And I used to work in a newsroom where it was my job to buy the booze on a Friday, and we used to get these two boxes of alcohol in, and everyone would get hammered, and there was never any non-alcoholic stuff. And even 10 years ago when I first quit, I'd go to events and there'd often only be orange juice.
Yes.
Like, who wants to drink
that? Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But now you'll find some lovely elderflower thing or, you know, sparkling Joa, blah blah. But I just wanted to touch on something you said earlier about people, part of the resistance or part of the what's hard is I've always said one of the hardest things is accepting it. Let me just talk about myself. The hardest thing for me was accepting that I was one of those people that couldn't moderate and control, because there are those who can, and that's it's sometimes hard to accept. Well, why can they? I want to be like them. And it's complex. We know addiction's complex, why someone can and why someone can't moderate this drug. But don't you feel like one of the big things that needs to happen for a person cognitively is that acceptance of, for whatever reason, I am one of those people that can't. And that's a big step.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's a different point for everybody, that acceptance. You know, it really is. And, you know, I see people with 10 DICs and worse who still haven't accepted, you know. And then I do see other people, fortunately, who haven't needed to lose their career and their family. You know, they're just kind of like they see there's no future in it. You know, it's taking from me. It's not giving. So I always say to people, you know, do your research. By all means, if you think you can moderate, do your research, but record it and review it when you're stone cold sober, because, you know, maybe this time, you know, it's kind of like there comes a point at which you've got to accept what the what your research has indicated. Yeah, and one of the other things I say to people is one of the criteria for people with an alcohol problem is not can you moderate, but can you consistently moderate?
Yes.
You know, if people will do it, it's like that intermittent schedule of reinforcement that reinforces gambling. Oh, well, that last night was good. Oh, I can do that again. So the next 10 nights are terrible, but you're still chasing that one night where I came home with my handbag and I didn't do anything too undignified. And
what did you call that thing with gambling?
Schedule of reinforcement. So if you put money in the pokies, every now and then you get a payout. Not every second time or every third time. It's not regular, but you just don't know. Maybe this time, you know, you put your coin in, maybe this time it'll pay out. Maybe that's what keeps people knowing every now and then it'll be okay. That's what keeps people repeating the same behavior. And it's like that with our drinking. Every now and then we have a night where, oh, I only had five, I was fine, I didn't, you know, I didn't drink and text and,
yes,
you know, all those things. Didn't argue, didn't, you know, I was, so every now and then you might have one of those nights or days and you think, oh, actually, no, I am okay. And you'll, you know, pursue that for another few years.
And isn't the brain so interesting that that will be the image of that night that'll be conjured up when you're trying to convince yourself that you're okay to drink again? Maybe you've had a period of being sober, and you'll be like, oh, and you picture that lovely fun night where you're just having a few and you're kind of loose, and not the night when you ended up with your face in the toilet vomiting, or like you say, losing your handbag or making a dick of yourself. I mean, oh my God, I shudder sometimes. Yeah, I remember some of my nights out.
Likewise. Oh God, likewise. Yes. But those are the ones that you remember. Yeah, but they say we're hardwired to forget the bad. And you know, with drinking, it doesn't serve us. So you need to be realistic when you're reviewing your evidence.
And I think that's so interesting also how you started this interview when I said, oh, it's been so long since you've had a drink. Can you remember back? And you were like, yes, I can, because I'm the same. I mean, I'm 11, coming up 12 years now sober, but I will never let myself forget that stumbling, heavy, disconnected, sloppy, slurry version of me. Never. Because if I do, I'll be right back there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Alcohol, drinking, that whole scene is so enticing that I could be back there in a heartbeat. I absolutely believe I've got more drinking in me, that I could be seduced one day into thinking, oh, it's a rosé, it's a sunny day.
Oh, I just got shivers. No, stop.
But then I remember rosés and sunny days are fine for some people. Yeah, it ends up my head down the toilet, having, you know, breached a whole lot of my personal values. It's no good. It's my kryptonite. Not just mine, there's many of us. And, you know, I'm allergic to wheat as well. You know, I don't eat wheat, but I don't spend my time going, it's not fair, I want to be like other people eating wheat. You know, you just like get on with it. But then people aren't. You know, wheat doesn't have the same place in our culture, does it?
No, that's right. Oh, my God, I love you. Okay, your clients must be so lucky to have your kind of straight talking. Do you lead with your lived experience when you're in your work, or do you make that a part of, I know you're open about it, say, on your website. Do you bring it into the room as well, or do you not try and share that so much and you just deal with the person in front of you?
I try to just deal with the person in front of me, because everybody's story is different and everybody has a, you know, I don't want that in the room as a blueprint. It's not about me. So the only time I would talk about, I mean, as you say, I'm open about it, but the only time I might talk about it is if I'm trying to illustrate, I'll use, you know, metaphor, I'll try and illustrate a point by sharing an experience that I've had that's parallel to perhaps what we're talking to. But so I think my lived experience is beneficial, just in the sense that, you know, people will say something and I, you know, I get it. Like, you know, I wanted to, I felt left out. I'm like, oh, yeah, tell me about it when you're the one not drinking. Or, you know, so there's a lot of things. Or I, you know, I don't know why I can't stop, even though I can see it's bad for me, or, you know, all these sorts of things. So that's where my lived experience has a role. Certainly, I'm quite open about it, but in a therapeutic environment, it's about the client. So I certainly, you know, we work with their story and their experience, and I do try quite hard to do that. I think that's important, because
it'll probably come through. even if you're not explicitly saying it, just because you've had that felt experience of the hope and the lightness that comes, it probably will just shine through when you're talking about the freedom, when you won't crave and you'll just be experiencing life and dealing with emotion, you know, in a grounded whole way. Even if you're not, you know, it'll just, the language you use will all, everything will be informed by the fact that you've had that felt experience.
I'm sure you're right. One of the things I try and instill in people too, as well as that hope, you know, is that feeling of, you know, you talk about the wise quiet one, but the wise quiet one, the reason I didn't want to go near them when I was drinking was because they were really comfortable in their own skin and very authentic. And I didn't want to go near that because they might see through me, you know. And that's what I get to be today, totally authentic, you know. Don't have to make my outside match my inside or try and be a particular way. I'm just, this is what you get. It's totally authentic all the time. And that is unnerving for someone who can't be authentic, as someone who's drinking really can't. But powerfully motivating, I think. Most people go, yeah, I want to be authentic. You know, I want to be who I am and comfortable in my own skin. Isn't that what we all kind of want, really?
Oh, my God, you've actually just helped me with something, which is around certain family members, extended family members who I sense are a little bit, you know, they're lovely towards me, but they don't want to get too close. And I'm not doing anything, and I don't try and sell, you know, I just am living or whatever. But maybe that's the thing, because they are, anyway. Yeah. This isn't a therapy session for me, but
it's so true. You'll find that people that avoid you like the plague. It's not about me, it's about them. They're sensing something. You can kind of see through bullshit, can't you? Do you find that when you're sober? You can't bullshit a bullshitter. And I think that's confronting for people.
Oh, my gosh. I'm just so happy to be sober. And so happy to chat to you. Yeah. Thank you a million for coming on. Full transparency, I stuffed up and didn't confirm this appointment. So poor old Simone, I was in half an hour, and she was like, So I really appreciate you. And I know that our members watching, listening to this will really appreciate listening as well. So thank you. I'll put links to your site. You know, I don't know if you're open to new clients, but I'll, just in case anyone wants to look you up. And really appreciate you coming on, and just keep up the great work.
Thank you, Lotta, and thanks for your interest, and thanks for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure to finally talk to you face to face.
I reckon. Okay, cheers.
All right, see you soon. Bye.